This is A Word, a podcast from Slate. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. It has been 10 years since Flint, Michigan made headlines when its citizens discovered their water was poisoning them. But long after the spotlight faded, Flint is still dealing with the consequences of the crisis. And millions more Americans are discovering their water is unsafe too.
Quite frankly, it is an issue everywhere. If it's not lead, it might be the water plant in your community is outdated and dilapidated. So these are things that if it has not hit you yet, over the next two decades, it most certainly will.
What we have and haven't learned from 10 years of the Flint water crisis. Coming up on A Word with me, Jason Johnson. Stay with us.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Welcome to Word, a podcast about race and politics and everything else. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. Clean water isn't supposed to be a concern in a country like the United States. Many of us take for granted that the water that comes out of our taps is free of contaminants, or it won't hurt us, and it won't make us sick. But in Flint, Michigan, that trust in the water supply was broken a decade ago, when highly elevated lead levels made the water unsafe for drinking, bathing, or even running through your pipes. And after 10 years, three different presidents, the activism of dedicated local citizens, and the attention of national environmental groups haven't fixed it. So what's happened to Flint? And is that city's fate destined to be repeated in other Black communities around the country? Joining us to talk about it is Adam Mahoney. He's a climate reporter for Capital B News. Adam Mahoney, welcome back to A Word.
Thanks for having me. Always good to be here.
You are a regular now. I'm very excited about this. For those who are unclear, what actually happened in Flint 10 years ago that marked the beginning of their water crisis?
The water crisis in Flint was really years in the making. At the specific moment in 2014, the city was attempting to find ways to save money in its process of delivering water. And one of the ways to do that was switching its source from the city of Detroit and Lake Huron to the Flint River. But they didn't put in place the protocols for treating the water. So when they made that switch, basically they were delivering dirty water to homes throughout the city.
What were some of the clearest impacts on community health when this started to happen? And are those issues still connected to the water supply now?
Yeah, I mean, lead poisoning spread pretty quickly throughout the city, and folks are still living with the remnants of that today. I spoke to parents who had children born, 50 days before the crisis started and expressed the ways that like rashes started to develop on their children's bodies. And then in the aftermath have been diagnosed with ADHD and on the autism spectrum. So things like that, those health impacts are impacting the younger generation. They'll continue to live with those effects while older folks are dealing with the physical health, but also the mental health elements as well. I talk to a lot of folks who to this day are living with high levels of stress, anxiety, which they directly connect to the water crisis.
So I want to talk about this more, because if you have basically a whole cohort, I mean, 10 years is almost three graduating classes of a high school, right? So what have we seen education-wise? Has there been a drop in standardized scores? Have there been increases in crime, people who have greater difficulty learning, adjusting, ADHD? What are some of the long-term effects we've seen?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Flint has shown us that a water crisis really can wreak havoc on all facets of life. And when we're thinking about education in the last decade, there's been roughly a 10% increase in the number of students with special needs within the school district, a school district that is struggling financially and doesn't have the resources to.
Hold on. I want to stop it. A 10% increase in the number of students with special needs.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I talked to parents, multiple parents whose children have developed, you know, learning disabilities, ADHD, and in a city that before the crisis did not have the resources to handle this, they definitely don't in the aftermath. I mean, even when we're thinking about the literal physical health impacts since the crisis, the Black death rate in the city has risen 2 times as quickly as the total death rate. And that's something we saw even before the COVID pandemic kind of widened that racial gap.
So, Adam, I'll be honest. I'm one of those people, I don't know Michigan very well. I think one of the things that I've been struck by is how this water crisis is very much a racial crisis. What's happening in Flint affected, or how has it affected sort of, you know, the racial divide throughout the state? You know, how has it resonated in places like Detroit? How has it resonated with white voters and Black voters and Latino voters? Because, you know, there's an underlying belief, and we've talked about this before, that these water crises tend to happen in Black cities. They tend to happen in cities that have Black leadership, and the state seems less interested in addressing issues that affect a primarily Black community. Has that resonated throughout the state? Is that how people see it? Or is that just my perspective as an outsider?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of residents really did get into the fact within Flint and Michigan more broadly that it has intensified kind of a racial gap and a racial divide. And folks are, quite frankly, on edge. Within the city of Flint, we saw pretty quickly that it's a very segregated city. And then within white neighborhoods, you know, the recovery looked a lot different, looked a lot quicker for folks there. And they're not still living with the impact in a way that a lot of the Black residents are. But also more broadly within the state over the last decade is, you know, Detroit has gone through its bankruptcy and economic woes, and Flint with the water crisis. There's been this surge within towns and cities in between the two, a really far right surge. You know, we saw the attempt of, you know, kidnapping the governor there a couple of years ago. And there's been a surge in far right white led groups. And it's really created this kind of cocoon is not the right word, but like just folks are not feeling safe to leave these cities because they've seen the ways that violence has intensified and an increase in really connecting the water crisis and these inequities to looking at these Black cities and Black people is inhuman in a lot of ways.
It reminds me a bit of COVID from the standpoint that you had some people who were concerned about COVID. You had some people who said COVID didn't exist. You had some people who said, well, COVID exists, but it's not that serious. Do you have that manifesting itself in Michigan, and does it have a racial component, right? Like, do you have white residents of the state saying like, it's not that bad. You know, you guys are just complaining, blah, blah, blah. Do you have, I mean, you know, are there Flint truthers who say, well, hey, there's really nothing in the water. It's all created one way or another. Do you hear those kinds of conspiracies popping up, and are they racialized like most other conspiracies in this country?
Yeah, exactly. I definitely did hear that. And I think, I mean, one of the interesting things there is the fact that the federal government for years now has said that the Flint water crisis is over. So even folks who are more quote unquote liberal or progressive have viewed, you know, that situation as being done with. So it's something that has allowed not only the crisis to, you know, to continue on, but also for residents there to feel left behind. I even talked to one resident, Angela Welch, who said she feels like these crises have been allowed to continue because ultimately they want Black residents to leave these two majority Black cities. So those are things that people are grappling with and living with. And even if, you know, maybe they're not 100% true, it is going to impact the way that you move throughout the world and the way that you can relate to people, be in community with people. Like I said, it's a crisis that extends well beyond just, you know, your water.
We're going to take a short break and we come back more on Flint 10 years into the water crisis. This is The Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. This is Jason Johnson, host of A Word, Slate's podcast about race and politics and everything else. I want to take a moment to welcome our new listeners. If you've discovered A Word and like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And let us know what you think by writing us at aword@slate.com. Thank you. You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about the 10th anniversary of the Flint water crisis with Capital B News environmental reporter Adam Mahoney. You begin your latest report on the Flint crisis by introducing us to resident John Ishmael Taylor. Tell us a little bit about him and how the crisis has affected his life and his family.
Yeah, I actually met Mr. Taylor at the public library in Flint. He has two biological children and two stepchildren who have directly felt the impacts of the Flint water crisis. He is one of the parents, like I mentioned, whose children have developed learning disabilities. And it's been really difficult for him as someone who grew up in Flint to see the way that a city can be destroyed. He really honed in on the point, the depressing point of, you know, seeing businesses leave, families and households leave and leaving their properties abandoned. The distress that you see from that and how literally just walking down the street creates this cast over life that is hard to shake. And he fears for what that means for his children. They will have the ability to leave the city. And if not, will they have the resources to thrive? He is still hopeful that the record-breaking civil settlement that Flint residents received will lead to some kind of change for his children. Although it's been 4 years since it was agreed upon and zero residents involved in the lawsuit have received any money.
So I want to follow up on that. So there was a $600 million civil settlement for the people of Flint. It was reached 4 years ago, but a lot of people haven't gotten their money. What is the holdup and who owed them the money? Was it a settlement negotiated by the EPA? Was it a settlement with the state? Was it a settlement with the company that made the pipes? Like, who is the settlement with and what's been the holdup in people getting their cash?
Yeah, so it was a settlement with the state, with a lot of different folks being forced to put money into the pot. But the reason why no resident has been paid out yet is because the state is claiming that all 90,000 folks who have put in for money have to go through the paperwork process first before anyone starts to receive money. So that's obviously a years long process. The irony there, which has caused a lot of pain for residents, is that lawyers have actually received money from that pot while they're sitting at home living with the true impacts.
One of the things about this, and I've seen this, in the state of Maryland, right, where, you know, you have a settlement that's negotiated under one governor, and then it kind of gets distributed in a different way by another governor. Flint is in this unique position where this started, you know, with a Republican governor. They now have a Democratic governor. It started, or at least it came to everyone's attention under the Obama administration. Trump talked about it during his administration. Biden is now here. Has there been any change in how Flint is dealt with depending on the party switches? I mean, have Republicans been any better at it than Democrats? Because at this point, it seems to me when you've crossed this many different changes in the state house, changes in state senate, changes in the federal government, changes in state government. Do the residents notice any difference in the parties and how it's handled?
Talking to folks, no. That's a part of the issue, right? On both the Republican leadership and the Democratic leadership over the last decade, because of the massive national attention that the crisis got. I mean, quote unquote, everything has been done right in the aftermath, right? There's been hundreds of millions of dollars invested into the city. Lead pipes have been slowly, albeit, but they've been replaced. And the issue is that the United States, as we attempt to replace all 9 million lead pipes and service across the country, they're using Flint as the playbook on how to do that. But residents are showing that Flint should not be used in that way because the crisis is still going on.
We're going to take a short break and we come back more about the ongoing Flint water crisis with journalist Adam Mahoney. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about the lessons of the Flint water crisis with environmental reporter Adam Mahoney. You know, Adam, since Flint, we've heard similar stories about water crises in parts of Alabama, parts of Mississippi, you know, all over the country. You mentioned before the break that the federal government is more or less trying to use Flint as a model. Other cities that have run into these problems with unclean, unsafe water, what lessons have they learned from Flint? Have they looked at Flint and said, well, darn, they haven't gotten anything in 10 years. I guess we have to be more radical about this. What has Flint done as far as action with other cities facing similar problems throughout the United States?
Yeah, I mean, that has been one benefit. A lot of the activists in Flint have taken their struggle across the country. There's a lot of coalition building between Flint and Jackson, for example. But even then, we're seeing in Jackson, residents there being locked out of all of the changes in the decision making around fixing their water crisis. And I think, you know, the issue is the way that, in particular, when we're thinking about lead service lines, the way that solving the crisis has been looked at is just replacing the infrastructure. But what Flint shows us is that even if you do replace the infrastructure, there might still be lead in your water. I talked to residents who, to this day, even years after their lead service lines were replaced, are still testing for lead in their drinking water at rates that are five times over the federal EPA limits. And that doesn't even take into consideration the ways that, you know, lead contaminated water can rip through the pipes in your home. So I talked to people who have had, you know, their toilets fall through the floor or, you know, to this day, black muck collecting in their shower heads every month. And those are things that are not considered when we're thinking about solving the quote unquote drinking water crisis, because it's the same water going through your pipe if you're taking a shower as well.
So I want to ask a little bit about that. You know, I can't help but think we ran through at least 3 years of being in a major global pandemic. And one of the solutions to the pandemic was to constantly wash one's hands. For the first, you know, 6 months, we were being told that we had to wash our food when we brought it home, wipe down boxes. What impact did the lack of clean water in Flint have on how COVID hit? How did this complicate COVID? Because I can't imagine that this was easy to handle with dirty water.
Exactly. Like I mentioned, that the Black death rate in the city has kind of climbed astronomically since the start of the crisis. And a big part of that widening of the racial gap was during COVID. And it was a result of, like you said, folks not having all of the resources that they need to survive a crisis like that, whether it be clean water or even economically. It's a city where the poverty rate is nearly two times higher than the federal average. Unemployment is really high. There are healthcare deserts, food care deserts. So all of those things coalescing creates a deadly crisis. And it's something that continues to exist in the aftermath, even as, you know, people like to frame the pandemic as being over.
There's a new study I was just reading about, talking about Tyson Foods and the fact that, you know, Tyson Foods has been just recklessly dumping wastewater from their, you know, meatpacking and rendering plants into rivers, making people sick all over the country. You mentioned that, you know, even if you replace the lead pipes in Flint, you still have lead traces. Has the research into the entire ecosystem around Flint led people to say, well, by the way, heck, we could have the most, we could have pipes made of, you know, perfect crystal, you know, adamantium, right? But there's still a meatpacking plant, you know, somewhere upriver. There's still an industrial farm somewhere upriver that's just dumping into clean dumping water. Has it led to sort of wider environmental awareness and activism throughout the northern part of Michigan? Or have people just sort of said, well, you know, let's deal with the water thing and then we go?
Based off of conversations with activists in Flint, I would definitely say it has led to that wider awareness and understanding all the different elements that go into a water crisis, including industrial pollution, like you're outlining. But the issue with at the government level, when we're thinking about water and solving that crisis, it's not a proactive attempt. And even then, when you're thinking about replacing those service lines, like we've talked about, you need to replace water plants, right? Across the country, well over half of all of the water plants in service are in need of either repair or revitalization. And those things cost a lot of money. And there are government subsidies available, but usually it still means a city is supposed to shell out at least half of the money required to make that fix. And as we know, water crises are concentrated in Black cities, and Black cities tend to be poor and don't have the resources to do that. So across the nation, as activists have been making these calls for this shift, it's also ironically led to an increase in like water bills and things like that, and the ways that governments are using that those funds and subsidies to do this work. So at the height of the Flint water crisis, Flint actually had the highest water bills in the nation, but you had dirty water flowing through your pipes.
You know, you talk about the activists who you've spoken to on the ground. I've got two questions about those. This is the first one. You know, activism is not necessarily a lifelong career, right? Like activists, they get burned out, they get tired, they get frustrated, sometimes they get jailed. It's been 10 years. Do you notice or have you found in your writing that there are activists who are like, I'm sick of this. They just moved. Are there activists who have said, you know, enough with this, I'm going to run for state government? I still follow Little Miss Flint on Twitter, but I still follow her. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I've seen this kid grow up. And even I've noticed her say, you know, we didn't meet our goal this year. We didn't meet our goal this month. I mean, this kid is about to graduate from high school. What has happened to the activists on the ground? You know, how have their lives changed? And are they still fighting the fight, or have they gotten up and left?
The activists I talked to, those folks are still deeply committed to the fight, obviously, but they have outlined the ways that, you know, the city losing 20% of its population over the last decade has allowed the crisis to fester and continue on. And the fact that, like, to be deeply committed to the fight, it does require a level of stability that most residents in Flint just do not have at this time, because every day is a struggle to get through. One of the really cool and inspiring things for me when I was in the city and talking to folks was the fact that the activism has kind of shifted to be a lot more holistic, right? And making those connections between the environmental injustices of a water crisis to the different factors of livability in a city. So when we're thinking about access to jobs, access to safe and affordable housing, in addition to access to clean water and air, those are a lot of the calls that are being made now. One of the big things talking to folks, they made the connection between, you know, housing insecurity and the water crisis. And in the aftermath of the start of the crisis in 2014, you know, housing struggles have ballooned in the city. Now to get into on the affordable housing wait list, that's even a 2-year wait before you can even, you know, wait another year or two to get into a property. So those things are all directly related to each other. And by calling for both of them at the same time, they're hoping to uplift the city a lot quicker.
What are the efforts at the federal level? This became a story at the end of the Obama administration. He said some things. Obviously, nothing changed. You know, Donald Trump ran chastising the Democrats and attacking Obama for not doing enough about Flint. He didn't do anything. If anything, he rolled back environmental regulations. And now we're at the end of the first term of the Biden administration, and it doesn't seem like much has changed. What has been done at the federal level other than throw money at it?
I would say throwing money at it has been a big part of that attempt to fix it. But in a kind of bittersweet way, talking to residents and talking to activists in particular, Claire McClinton, you know, she outlined the way that really Flint's water crisis was the flashpoint for the focus on infrastructure in this country, right? And we've seen in the aftermath, billions of dollars be invested all across the nation. You know, we're seeing the attempt to replace all 9 million lead service lines. We're seeing the attempts to improve our roads and our highways and water plants and things of that nature. But at the same time, which is why it's bittersweet, Flint, the guinea pig, is still wallowing in that despair.
If I'm listening to this podcast right now, and I think I may be living in the next Flint, right? I'm in some town in Texas. I'm in some town in Utah. I'm in some town in Ohio, wherever it is. If you think the water is unclean or unsafe in your city, what's a lesson from Flint? What are you supposed to do? Like, I mean, the average person doesn't know where a quote unquote lab is. If I'm under the impression that the water is unsafe in my community, what are some of the first steps you should take?
The first step is always testing, you know, your water for lead. And a lot of places, it is a free process. It might not be that simple, but it usually starts with either going to, you know, your city hall or your local county public health system and getting an at-home test, and then you send it back to them and they'll send it to a state lab and get you those results. So the first step is identifying if it is truly a crisis. And then after that, residents in Flint really hampered down on the fact of building like a community coalition, make sure folks on your street and your neighborhood are also doing that. And if it does come back as an issue, to build together as a group rather than an individual fighting these things is always makes it a lot stronger and easier to eventually push for change. But the thing is, quite frankly, it is an issue everywhere. If it's not lead, it might be, like I said, the water plant in your community is outdated and dilapidated. So these are things that if it has not hit you yet over the next two decades, it most certainly will.
I always like to end the show on, you know, an optimistic note. How can people participate? How can they help? How can they get involved? If you're a resident outside of Flint, if you're someone who's like, oh man, I can't believe this has been 10 years. If you're someone who's hearing this story right now and you want to help the residents of Flint, you want to help them move one step forward. Again, I know, you know, Little Miss Flint still has the thing about, you know, sending donations for water and water filters. What are the best ways that people outside of Flint, Michigan can still help and help save this city?
Yeah, I mean, Little Miss Flint is, like you said, obviously she's still raising funds every single day on social media on her GoFundMe for water filters to be used in households throughout the city. That's one way to directly get involved is donating to her campaign. And there's a lot of organizations that have been born out of the crisis. One in particular, Flint Rising, has created a very large ecosystem that has touched a lot of different people in that city to this day. And they're still doing active work around testing water levels, providing, you know, plastic water bottles to folks, water filters. So that's one organization to donate to or to attempt to get involved with. They've created coalitions throughout the nation, actually. I live in New Orleans, and I was at an event last week that they had in solidarity with the Water Collaborative there. So those are things that, you know, they exist in cities and you can find ways to get involved.
Adam Mahoney is an environmental reporter for Capital B News. Thanks, man. I really appreciate it whenever you're on, and thanks for keeping an eye on this issue.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. Appreciate you.
And that's a word for this week. The show's email is aword@slate.com. This episode was produced by Christy Taiwo Macanjula. Ben Richmond is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the Vice President of Slate Audio. Our theme music was produced by Don Will. I'm Jason Johnson. Tune in next week for a word.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.